Hey, before we get started, I have a quick word from our sponsor, Lynda.com. If you've been making New Year's resolutions to improve yourself, pick up new skills, or just have fun, you could go to Lynda.com and find the courses that are now being used by over 1 million people spread across 3,000 courses on topics like web development, photography, visual design, business, plus software like Excel, WordPress, and Photoshop. It's all taught by experts. And when you have an account, you can take as many of the classes you want, all for the same price. But that price is going to be zero if you take our 10-day free trial by visiting Lynda, Lynda.com/longform. You'll be helping support the show, plus getting yourself 10 days of access to every course on Lynda.com, even if you're on your iPhone or Android device, plus all the new courses they add every week. Some stuff I thought looked pretty interesting is there's a podcasting with GarageBand course, a getting things done course, and a grammar fundamentals course, which I could probably use. Do something good for yourself in 2015 and sign up for that trial at Lynda.com/longform. Thanks, Lynda. Now on to the show.
Hello. Welcome to the Longform Podcast. I'm Max Linsky. I'm here with my co-hosts, Aaron Lammer, Evan Ratliff. Gentlemen, hello.
Hey.
Hey, guys.
What's going on? Rainy Mondays.
Winter rain. It's the worst. It's the fucking worst.
I'm having some kind of an allergy on my face that's causing my lips to sizzle and my skin to splotch.
It seems like it's stalled out,
though. I can't see a thing.
Oh, it's really going to be a brutal irony if the shrimp has come back to haunt you.
I don't want to address that that eventuality.
We'll address that in a later podcast.
Yeah, Shrimpcast. Who's on the show this week?
This week I interviewed Alex Blumberg, who many people will know from This American Life and Planet Money, and maybe his latest venture, which is his first for-profit venture. He has started a podcasting network called Gimlet, and he's doing a show in true like Alex Blumberg fashion about the founding of his company, which is called Startup. And it's like next to Serial, it's the hit podcast of 2014.
Definitely. Well, and Gimlet does another podcast called Reply All that Max and I were guests on a couple weeks ago.
It's true.
Check that out.
So we talked a lot about, I think Alex is our first radio person that we've had on the podcast. So we talked a lot about both like how you make a radio story and also then quite a bit about the podcasting industry. Boom times in podcasting.
Not our first radio person, though. We had Starley on.
Oh, true.
That's true.
Yeah.
That's true. I don't remember anything from 2012.
That's true. That was a long time ago.
2012.
Yeah.
I've been doing this podcast for a long fucking
good God.
Time.
But as a general rule, I think we're starting to see more overlap between people who are doing reporting in podcasts and in print and video. So we're going to try and keep abreast of that and have on people who are doing interesting stuff.
Convergence.
Yes. Synergy.
Synergy. What about sponsors?
We have a new sponsor. I'm excited about this sponsor. You guys are excited about this sponsor, I know, because both of you are the proud owners of a new alarm system.
Yeah.
Thanks to Alarm Grid.
Yeah.
Alarm Grid is a DIY security company. I set up my alarm. I don't know if you guys have set up your alarms yet. It's super easy. They send you an alarm. It's like 10 bucks a month. You can use it with any service, but they are like a gimmick-free, no-hassle alarm company.
Yeah, and there's kind of no lock-in to it, right? Because they give you the stuff and you can plug it into any alarm system.
That's their whole thing, is like the security game is kind of rigged.
Yeah.
And they're trying to give you the like straight ahead, this is a security system, you can cancel anytime, this is what it costs, there's no extra weird surcharges. It's pretty great.
Yeah, I like it.
I don't think I have any stuff worth stealing, but I put it on for my cat.
As soon as I get anything worth stealing,
my cat.
Well, you do have a fancy cat.
That's what I'm talking about. Someone tries to steal my cat, they better watch out.
He's like half
fancy. Because I got one of these things.
Alarmgrid.com. Go check them out. We're very, very happy to have them sponsoring the show.
Wow, I that whole time I was trying to think of a good transition from a security alarm to newsletters, and I just came up blank. So I'm just going to say Tiny Letter is the best way to start an email newsletter. It's simple. It'll get you writing, which is what's the point of communicating with other people and spending your time trying to set up some kind of crazy mailing list. So thanks, Tiny Letter.
And I got a quick plug for the latest Atavist story, which is called Company 8. It's by Matthew Pearl. It's the oldest story we've ever done. It's from the 1830s. It's basically about the origins of firefighting in America and the one man who fought to make it happen. It's a pretty incredible story. So check it out on our website, atavist.com.
Here's Max and Alex Blumberg.
Alex Blumberg, welcome to the podcast. We are recording this at your office, not at my office.
Yes.
And I'm already getting radio tips. It's fantastic.
Exactly.
This is my whole, one of the things I'm very excited to talk to you about is I feel like this could be a self-improvement hour. I feel like I could become better at this just in the course of our hour.
Well, I could teach you a lot about mic placement. That's true.
And so I have all these questions that are kind of like somewhat parallel questions to writing, mm-hmm. but for radio, which I haven't been able to ask anyone. And I saw Matt Lieber, mm-hmm. who's your...
Ooh, my co-founder.
Co-founder, you call him co-founder. Mm-hmm. I saw Matt Lieber on Monday night at a bar, and I told him I was going to interview you, and I asked him what I should ask you. And he said, everyone in our office talks about good tape. Like it's God. And he started talking about the reverence you guys have for good tape. And so I was hoping maybe we could start and you could explain to me what good tape is.
All right. Well, good tape, first of all, starts with not having the P's pop.
You keep fucking it up.
No, that's all right. Just stay right there.
Okay.
All right. But there are actually people, just as an aside, I think there's like a lot of people in the radio community that over fetishize like sort of like mic placement and like getting the perfect sort of intimate sound at the expense of like story.
Like worry so much about the tech that they don't actually focus on the
and
person.
Like
in
it's
the
very
room.
Sound rich or whatever. And it's, you know, fucking boring or incomprehensible or something like that, you know? So when we talk about good tape, what we're talking about is like a moment that sort of happens in an interview that's like arresting for whatever reason. Either it's arresting because there's some sort of, it's like a raw emotional moment, or it's arresting because like it was unexpected or something surprising happened. Or good tape also is like just somebody who's telling like a really compelling story.
How is good tape different than just a good conversation? We've been talking for a while. Like, how is it different when it's for the radio?
Yeah, we haven't had any good tape yet.
Nothing.
Not yet. No. Not
and
anything,
you know.
Not anything that we... No, I mean, it's been like, so when we're talking about good tape, like I want to distinguish like sort of like there's a couple of different kinds of sort of like tape out there. And so like a lot of podcasts are pretty good because it's like people talking in a normal way and they're like having a nice interaction and they're talking sort of honestly and like there's nice interaction. So that's one element of good tape, was when you can sort of feel like the camaraderie, you can feel that like sort of like the intimacy. So in that sense, I think so far we've had a pretty good tape conversation. I'll let you know when we get some good tape.
Okay, that'd be good. You can just give me like a little like a pat.
But I think when we're talking about it, we're talking about like the moment from the interview where you were sort of like, that was good. That was where like something crystallized or something felt powerful or something felt like where you would never stop listening.
I mean, you've been doing this for a long time now. Do you know that as soon as it's happening? Are you like editing in your head as you're talking to somebody?
Now I do. One, I know it better. Two, I now know how to engineer it better to make sure that it happens a little bit better. I mean, it's hard to get it to happen, but like now I know, like early on, like this, you know, the experience that you have when you first start on radio is that you go out and you do your story and you're really excited about it. You're doing your story and you get this, you've gotten an assignment from some public radio station somewhere. You go out, you do the story and you come back and you
guys should know that Alex is doing like a little jig while he talks.
You go, you know, get your kit together and you go out and you do the interview and it's like for some 3 minute or 4 minute story on the public radio station about zoning laws or whatever. And you end up talking and like it's your first story. So you talk to the guy for like an hour and a half and like it's some sort of like, you know, county comptroller who's like, nobody's ever talked to me for an hour and a half before in my life. And you're like, I got some really good stuff. And then you go back and you listen to it and it's just like, it was like all like utterly boring. Or you go out and you talk to somebody and they say something sort of like pretty amazing. He's like, you know, like, you know, that was back before like we had the, you know, the giant comptroller scandal of 96 or whatever. And you're like, yeah, but anyway, tell me more about like the zoning rules. And then you go back and you're listening to your tape and you realize, wait, why didn't I do a follow-up about the comptroller scandal? Like, that's the interesting part. Like, I want to hear more about the comptroller scandal. And I would have that over and over and over again, where it was like painful to listen back to my tape. I would be listening back to the tape and be like, oh my God, ask this follow-up. It's an obvious follow-up question. Like an obvious follow-up question. Like, why? Or how did that make you feel? Or say more about that. Like just that. Like somebody says something interesting and I'd be like, oh my God, ask the follow-up. And you'd have this mounting sense of dread that you didn't ask the follow-up. And then you just breeze right by it and you'd like make some stupid joke. And like that happened over and over and over again. And that's how you learn how not to miss those moments and then instead to like actually dwell on those moments and sort of like stick with them until you get good tape.
Right, because one thing that's different about the writing is like you can always call the person back.
Yeah.
Right, you can always like get the quote. You can also always ask that follow-up. But if you only have that moment with them, that recorded moment.
Yeah.
You sort of have to get it right the first time.
Yeah. You can even go back. I mean, I've done that before where I've like blown the interview and then I go back and I'm like, you know, I listen back and I was like, I realized that there's a couple follow-up questions. And sometimes that works, actually. It often works because often it's like not something that people don't want to talk about. They just have to be primed. Right. They'd have to be asked the question, you know? So it's a lot of times it's just sort of like being able to ask the right question at the right time.
I guess like I'm thinking about it in terms of the podcast too, because like it would be weird if you and I sat and talked for an hour and then I called you up tomorrow and I was like, I forgot to ask you one thing. And then we like cut it into the middle.
Yeah.
It would feel like sort of disingenuous or something.
Yeah, yeah.
I guess I'm interested in how you've gotten better as a listener. Because missing the comptroller scandal of 96, that's just like you're just thinking about your next question, not it's like, really listening to what they say.
So, I mean, the real example is sort of like what you do if somebody starts talking about something difficult. And like what will happen is somebody will start to talk about something. And this happened a lot in the beginning. You get to something and then somebody unexpectedly gets emotional about it. And you're like, whoa, what's going on here? And your normal human reaction is to sort of like comfort and steer away. You know, comfort and be like, oh, I'm sorry. Let's move on. And what you need to do if you want good tape is to say, talk more about how you're feeling right now. And it feels like a horrible question to ask. It feels like I'm like going against my every instinct as a decent human being to like go towards the pain that this person is experiencing right now for whatever reason. So that's a lot of what it was, like sort of like not recognizing the emotional moment. And then if the emotional moment happens, not shutting up. That was another thing that I did all the time in the beginning, was like I would just like rush to fill the silence. And not just let the person sort of like, they start to say something and then it's like this, there's this uncomfortable like 3 minutes or 3 seconds of like, 3 seconds of dead air. Like, let's just do it right now. Hold on. Ready? That was 3 seconds. It's like, uncomfortable,
heavy.
Right?
Yeah.
It's like,
yeah. Host, right? I just have to move in my chair.
Right? You're like, I want to fill that sudden, you know, it's scary. And so you do you want to fill that space, you know, and when in fact, that's good tape. That's probably a good moment, probably. That little 3 seconds of silence probably will be a good tape of this thing, you know, because it's like unexpected.
It seems like you're doing that in your head. As we're talking, you're sort of editing this conversation in your head.
Yes.
Was that something you were able to do early?
Oh, no.
That's new.
Well, I mean, I learned it over time. Your dog just farted.
Awkward pause. I brought my dog to your office in this tiny studio, and I believe she just farted.
That's good tape.
Awkward pause.
That was an unexpected. That was something unexpected.
Thank you, Reba, for breaking this up.
She's a good producer. It didn't just happen. I mean, it was like, it was something, I've been doing this now for like forever. You know, I feel like I'm now like sort of a lifer. Like I've been doing this since 97, I guess, basically, depending on how you count, which is getting up on 20 years. And so, you know, there was a long learning curve of sort of like doing it, going out and getting tape, logging the tape, yelling at myself for not asking the right follow-up, coming to grips with the fact that I didn't ask the right follow-up, you know, and then not having anything to show for my, you know, 2 hours of interview. And then gradually you'd start to recognize like, oh, no, that was a good moment and that was a good moment. So it took a while. But now I feel like it became – when did it become sort of almost second nature was probably like 7-8 years ago where I was like – where I really felt like, okay, now I know what I'm going for.
So it's like 10 years.
Yeah.
10 years to become like a radio natural.
Yeah. Yeah, probably.
That's the rule. It's the Gladwell rule.
Yeah.
Let's talk about the beginning. I'm interested in how you got your start doing this.
I guess I got my start through the written word. I was an intern at Harper's. That was my first sort of like job in journalism back in 94, I believe. And I was a private school science teacher for 4 years.
Before Harper's or after Harper's?
Before and during. I had a brief run as a nonprofit bureaucrat right out of college. But then I was like, then I got my job as a teacher, and I was a teacher for 4 years. And one summer, we had the summers off, and one of the summers I had an internship at Harper's.
But you were, even while you were teaching and working as a social worker, you were interested in trying to do this work?
I was interested in this work, but I did not try to do it because somehow I got it in my head that like, somebody like me could never do this work. I don't know why. I grew up in Cincinnati. I went to public school in Cincinnati. In retrospect, I have no idea why it seemed like such a far-fetched idea that I could ever have an actual professional job in the media. you know, like imagine that an upper middle class Jewish kid gets a job in the media. How would that ever happen? You know
what
I mean?
How did Alex Bloomberg do it?
But like, it somehow it didn't occur to me. I didn't know anybody. Like, you know,
You didn't know anyone who was doing it.
I didn't know anyone who was doing it. I didn't know how anyone did it. Nobody I knew had a job. Like people were like, you know, whatever, dentists or lawyers or whatever they were, but nobody worked in the media. Like it wasn't like a job. It didn't seem like it felt like saying like, yeah, I'm going to be a rock star. I'm going to be a member of the Rolling Stones.
It felt like, that far away?
Well, yeah, sort of. Like it was like, well, there are five members and they don't need no job openings.
They don't need the Jewish kid from Cincinnati?
Exactly. It just felt like that, you know? And then I started to meet people. Basically, I had a girlfriend who grew up in New York and went to an Ivy League school and for whom this was like not a crazy thing to think that you would one day have a job at a magazine. And so that's when I started to think like, oh, well, maybe I'll just apply for this. And then I learned about the internship and I read The New Yorker and Harper's all the time, like religiously, like I loved it. Like I was a big reader and a big consumer of that. And so then I was just like, well, maybe I'll apply. And then I applied. And
there's a pretty, pretty serious line of Harper's people who've been like through this podcast. I feel like it's like half the people who've come on the show started at Harper's or had their time there or whatever.
Well, I feel like Harper's in the late 80s, early 90s was sort of like the Yankees, you know, like, you know, the heydays. Like there, it was just like a lot of heavy hitters there, you know.
It was like the Yankees, except no one was getting paid like they were on the Yankees.
Right. And everybody was, you know, much less coordinated and a lot weaker.
Yes.
Because I did play on the Harper softball team, and I can tell you, in that way, we were nothing like the Yankees.
Yeah, getting waxed by High Times.
Exactly. Yeah. So that happened, and then I came back and I taught for another year, and then I got a job as the administrative assistant at This American Life.
How'd you get that job?
I sort of aggressively sent them a bunch of sort of pitches that were horrible. Ira reached out to me and was like, I just need somebody to help with like administrative stuff. And I was like, sure, I'll do it. So I did it.
Hey, it's Max. I'm going to pause things for just a second and tell you a little bit about our sponsor this week. It's Alarm Grid. I don't know about you, but I've never actually owned an alarm system before. And part of that, admittedly, is because I've never actually owned anything nice enough to protect. But the other reason is that setting up an alarm system always seemed like a huge ordeal, crazy pain in the ass. It was like, felt like getting cable installed, only worse. Alarm Grid realized that. They knew it was a heavy lift, and so they decided to make the process of getting an alarm super easy. Their whole focus is consumer experience. That means that installation is a breeze. I am in no way handy, like negative handy, and I set up my alarm in 5 minutes this week. They've got this really easy-to-follow YouTube video. If you hit a snag, you can call them. They'll walk you through it. Customer support is totally free with Alarm Grid. Free is actually an important word. All of their pricing is totally straightforward. Everything is upfront. There's no gimmicks. There's no activation fees. There are no contracts, no hidden charges. Everything is upfront and clear, and you can get monitoring going for just $10 a month with Alarm Grid. So go check them out. Thanks so much to them for sponsoring the show, alarmgrid.com. And let's get back to Alex. Why are you interested in This American Life? Why radio and not like a magazine?
At that point, I wasn't interested in radio. I was just interested in sort of like a job where you could tell the kind of stories that I wanted to.
Like, were you writing pitches all over Chicago? Were you pitching The Reader in Chicago Magazine?
Yeah, yeah, I was. I was looking for all kinds of different jobs. But even at that time, like This American Life had already started to have like a, you know, a bit of a buzz. I think it already won like a Peabody at that point, and people knew about it. It was like a cool new thing that was happening.
So you show up, your administrative assistant at This American Life, and I went back and listened to like some early Alex Bloomberg episodes.
Oh God,
they sound pretty similar, actually.
Really?
Yeah. There's like there. I feel like there's maybe a little bit more like excitement. Not excitement. Excitement is not the right word.
Yeah.
The look on your face made me say excitement is not the right word. But it kind of is. You're like wide-eyed.
Yes.
You seem to be really excited to be doing it.
Yes, I was. Like which ones were you listening to?
Like a radio station rebranding itself.
Oh, yeah.
And there is this era, which like I empathize with some of like, I remember from like early newspaper days, of just like you seem to be just like kind of shocked that you were talking about this on the radio.
Yeah. So the backstory to that story is sort of like I came in and like so I at this point I was a freelancer, so I'd worked there as the administrative assistant for a while, and I just because there was nobody there and it was like I have, it's funny because I'm going through the same thing right now starting this company, and like we have like, we're just trying to do so much and we don't have enough people, and like anybody who's like a warm body or is like, hey, can you do this? You know, and like, and that happened back then. Like it was just Ira and I think three producers, and there was just not enough, you know, people to go around. And so he like grabbed me and threw me. He was like, I'm trying to produce a show about Harold Washington, the first black mayor of Chicago. Can you just help produce it while you're doing all your other administrative stuff? And I was like, obviously, of course I can. So like I worked to try to help, you know, produce it with air quotes. Like I had no idea what I was doing. But like I booked interviews and I sort of like organized the tape and I learned how to cut on Pro Tools and stuff like that. So I was doing all that. And then we ended up producing the Harold Washington show, which was like a train wreck of a production week. And like it almost didn't get on the air, but it finally did. And like it ended up being, you know, sort of like an early hit of a show. And so I thought, all right, I made it. This
like
is my
you were
test.
Made, man. Yeah.
I've passed. I will now become an official producer. So I went to Ira afterwards and he was like, hey, can you mail these, you know, letters off or whatever? Like, wait, I thought I'm a producer now. And he was like, well, I can't make you a producer. I don't have the money to make you a producer. And even if I could, I don't know if I would, because like, you know, maybe I would want to hire somebody else. And I really, and at the time it was a little bit of a blow, but it was also really liberating. Like that was a really good thing of him to tell me. And I was like, well, why wouldn't you hire me? Like I just did the Harold Washington thing. And he was like, yeah, I know, but like there's other people who have lots more experience. Like I would hire somebody like, I don't know, like Joe Richman or somebody, you know, somebody who's been doing this for a while and knows what they're doing. And I was like, oh, and I was like, well, what would you want me to do to get experience? And he was like, I don't know, maybe like freelance a lot and just get a bunch of stories under your belt. So I was like, okay. So then I was like, okay, so I guess I'll quit then and try to do that. So I quit and I like started freelancing. And so this was like that radio story wasn't during the freelancing months. And like I'd sent them the idea, like I knew they were doing the show called First Day, and I'd like had been listening to this radio show. I'd heard it go off the air and rebrand itself. And I came in and they did an interview, and then there had been some buzz about doing some sort of story without like non-narrated, you know, just like sort of like just the voice without any narration. And somehow that got mixed up with like also giving the intern at the time, I don't remember who it was, but like a cutting exercise. Somehow my interview became the focal point of both those impulses. And so like they were like, we're going to make this non-narrated and we're going to give it to the intern to cut. And so I remember, so like I'm like hyper in that one because like they cut out all the questions and all they left was my laughter. So it's like, it's a really weird, I find it a really weird piece because like, it's obvious that I'm responding to somebody who's asking me all these questions.
It's only obvious to you. It sounds,
oh, really?
It sounded to me like you were just kind of like sitting in your car almost.
And giggling to myself a lot.
Pretty much.
Yeah. Exactly.
And the giggling is what made me think like you seem pretty excited to be doing it.
Yeah, because they cut out every single question. Anyway, it's a fun piece though. And the tape was good.
So that was what, 1997, that you were sitting in your car giggling, so happy
to
be on this
97,
American
98,
Life.
Yep.
And you were how old?
I mean, I was old. I was like almost 30, I think, at this point. So this,
okay,
I,
it's okay to be that excited when you're 30. You shouldn't be ashamed of that.
Yeah.
And then for the next, what, 15 years, you were a producer at This American Life.
Yeah. I got hired again in 99. So I was like, I freelanced for like a year and a half, and I did a bunch of stories.
It sounds like you were sort of getting experience in a bunch of places and Harper's and stuff, but how do you think working at This American Life shaped you as a journalist?
Well, in every way. I mean, I think I learned so much from there. I think it's really like, it's funny, like, especially now running, you know, starting this company and sort of putting together long form podcasts, you know, journalistic podcasts, I realized that it was a pretty amazing shop. It was a pretty amazing boot camp for like how to do this kind of long form storytelling. I think I internalized a lot of the lessons. So like, everything that I know, what I think of as good tape, I think I learned from This American Life. Yeah, obviously, the way I talk has been inspired by my time at This American Life.
I'm glad you brought it up because I think that was like the thing I was kind of pussyfooting around asking.
Yeah.
But I went back and listened to those early ones in part to see whether you were talking the same way then as you do now, which is kind of this, feels like this, like This American Life tone.
Right.
And it was pretty similar, even in like 97. It sounded like you. I mean, maybe more like giggling.
You know, you develop, there's a cadence, there's a house style that like, and so, well, the trick is that like, it's really hard to talk like yourself on the radio, especially when you're reading a script that you've written. It's surprisingly difficult to sound like your natural self. And so what you have to do is you have to learn how to fake the real you on the radio. And in the beginning, that's really hard. And so what you end up doing is you end up impersonating. So one of the things that you do as a producer, I would do this all the time, is I would coach people to read. And if they were pretty bad readers, which most people are because they don't know how to do it, you have to just coach them and you give them and you're just like, no, try it this way. And then you give them the way you would do it. And then they just parrot you better than they can do themselves. And then that becomes sort of their style. So that happened to me. Like it was just sort of like, and I think that's how a house style develops. Like you're learning how to be natural on the radio, and being natural is not at all the same thing as just sounding like yourself.
Do you now feel like you sound like yourself? Have you closed that gap?
Well, now I feel like, it's impossible to tell. I've so internalized that house style that has become me. Like I can't tell if I've grown into it or it's become
it's
me.
It's like taking you over.
Yeah, I don't know. Am I the man or the mask?
I mean, but the house style is also kind of like Ira Glass's style.
Yeah, absolutely.
You just went there immediately, so it was something you were aware of. Like, as you were moving along with the show, were you like, man, I gotta figure out my own thing?
Oh, no. I mean, there's so many things to figure out. Partly is like, I didn't know it, and I still don't hear it, but it's everybody says it to me.
Really?
So I just have concluded that it must be true, so I'm all right with it. But I just never, I myself don't hear it at all. Like, I think we sound utterly distinct. So, like, that's part of the problem. It's like, it's a phenomenon that is, you know, widely apparent to everybody who listens. But to me, myself, I don't get it. And then also, there's just so many things to learn. You know, developing a style that was more my own was just sort of like so low on the list of priorities of sort of like, how do I get better at this? That it was like not even something that I necessarily thought about, yeah.
Once you had people kind of coming up to you again and again and saying it, was it something you felt like you should like break off from?
Like by the point that I sort of accepted it as a fact, it was like I had been fully baked. I am who I am now.
There is no guy.
I don't sound like him. He sounds like me.
Going back through your archive, you're doing stories, all kinds of different stories. Uh-huh. Sort of seems like kind of whatever you're curious about, you're following. And then there's this point, I don't know, late 2000s, where you start doing like the business stuff.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm interested in that moment and what sort of prompted you to tackle those stories.
Like, it's funny, like I thought of it as that moment too, but like I think even if you go back, like I was surprised to see, like I remember there was this one story that I did about like this bad stock tip that a friend gave me. And that was like in 2002 or something like that. And I think even there I was like, oh, I was sort of interested in sort of like how this world works. It's just such a mysterious world. And I felt like...
Were you a financially savvy person?
No. I don't know anything about money. And to this day, like my wife will tell you, like I don't know the value of a dollar. I literally don't know the value of a dollar. Like I could go into a store and there'd be like, it's $25 or it's $5. And I would not know the difference. Like I don't know. I just can't pay attention to that kind of stuff. But I like figuring out how systems work. Like I was a physics major for a while in college. And I like explaining the rules of like how... the rules that govern behavior. And I feel like money is that for sure. Like there are these rules that govern behavior and they involve the financial system. So I think that was part of what drew me to it. And then it was just sort of like, it just happened to be the biggest story of our time. You know, like it just, like I had gotten into it like in 2005. I remember thinking for the first time, like I was like, what is going on? Like the first time I was like a producer at This American Life bought a house. And I was like, oh, how'd you buy a house? Because I knew what we both made, and I was like, I can't afford my house. And she was like, oh, we just got a loan. And I was like, well, didn't you have to put money down? And she was like, no, we didn't have to put any money down. And I was like, wait, you didn't have to put down a down payment? And the last time I'd ever heard of people buying or selling houses was like probably like in the 80s when I was in high school or something, like where like right. Somebody's parents had bought a house or something like that. And then I'd gone to college and I'd been poor my whole life and renting and buying was never on the horizon. And then all of a sudden I had a nice job all of a sudden and like, and here was this person who was buying a house. And I was like, oh, things have changed, I guess. The last time I checked in on this, which was like a decade and a half ago, you had to have a down payment. And now you don't seem to.
Now they just give you a house.
Yeah, now they just give you a house. And a big house for a lot of money in, you know, downtown Chicago. And I was like, oh, that's really interesting. So that was the first thing. And then I was like, and then everybody I knew had this massive credit card debt. And I was just thinking, like, what is going on? Like, it's not getting paid back. And so that started me down the road of, like, what is happening? And then I got into the mechanics of it. And then from that, I learned that most of the craziness was happening in the mortgage market, and I started getting into the mortgage market. And then that's sort of where I like became obsessed, like an obsessive about it. And it was like a true, like sort of like I would be up late at night reading finance and housing blogs. Like, just like, I knew the commenters on the blogs by name, and I was like, oh, that guy always says this. You know, it was like that kind of thing.
I don't know anything about writing for the radio. Uh-huh. Writing that story, how is that different? Maybe we could use that as an example. I literally know nothing about it, like how it's different than writing a story for a magazine.
Well, there's a lot less punctuation. I mean, you're just, it's a lot easier. So I wrote magazines and I wrote radio for a while. Like, I did both. And like the radio, so much of the work is done with the person's voice. So good tape means that you as a writer get to be lazier because like so much of the scene has been established by the person talking. So if there's a lot of emotion or if there's a lot of nuance or there's a lot of complexity and it comes across in the tape, that's like a lot less work you have to do as a, you know, descriptively for in the writing. And what you end up doing, you also have to be a lot shorter. You have to be super brief. You can do a lot more with your voice. So if you look at radio scripts, it doesn't look like much is being conveyed. But if you listen to them, like there's a lot more. You can do a lot of work with your voice that you don't have to do on the page. My early scripts were like way, way, way more written. And as I've gotten older and, you know, more practiced at it, it's barely sentences anymore.
It's like talking points.
It's more than talking points. It's like, you know, you get the language that you want to say, you get it right, but it's like fragments. And like everybody who's in it does different things. Like Ira, if you look at his scripts, it's sort of like, it's phrase, ellipsis, phrase, ellipsis, phrase, ellipsis, the whole paragraph. There's no commas, there's no periods, there's no capital letters. It's just like phrase, ellipsis, phrase, ellipsis, phrase, ellipsis. And it'll be exactly what he says, but that's just how he writes it. So it's like every radio person almost invents their own punctuation. David Kestenbaum, who worked at Planet Money, who's like, I think, one of the greatest radio reporters around, it's like all periods. It's just like short declarative sentences, period, 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 just super short. And like what I do is I tend to do a lot of run-on sentences that I'll just like stick a period in. Stick a comma in every once in a while. It's a lot of commas and dashes, but not many periods.
And then what's the editing process? Like at This American Life, I don't know if that's the same that you're using at Planet Money or Gimlet, but you write this thing, like then do you go read it in front of everybody?
Yeah, and then you do a live read. So you like you get your script and then you read it and then you play the tape from the computer and then you read some more and then you play the next piece of tape from the computer. And if there's like some sort of ambient sort of thing in there, you'll say that. Or if you're imagining music coming up, you say music here and then you just go on. So it's like a table read essentially.
So that story comes out. Mm-hmm. It is a hit. Mm-hmm. Resonates. People like me listen to it and say like, I finally understand what just happened. And I assume it was a pretty logical move then to start doing Planet Money and more money stuff. Or maybe I assume wrong.
So Adam Davidson, the co-reporter on the Giant Pool of Money, was like, this is amazing. Like we now, and he was at NPR and he'd been a correspondent at NPR, and he was like, we discovered something here. We have to go big on this. Like there is a hunger now to learn this stuff, and we should just like do a show that like sort of explains these complicated financial. So, and I was like, I don't know, man, this was like a once in a lifetime story, man. Like this was just like, this is like, you can't try to, like, it's like trying to relive your glory days in high school or something like that, like what you're trying to do. And like, I was not into it. And he was like very, very persuasive. And so I was like, okay, well, yeah, it's true. It's interesting. I've learned some stuff. So maybe we can do a show. So I sort of half committed to like one day a week working. And then we took all summer and we put together this one podcast that was going to be the first Planet Money podcast. And it was about bearing manufacturers in the United States and windmill manufacturers in China and some complicated story about how that supply chain was all linked together. I don't remember what it was. A good story, but it was like not anything financial related or anything. So we had this whole thing set to go. And then it was going to launch on a Monday. And then the weekend before that Monday, Fannie and Freddie collapsed. And I was on vacation because I was supposed to be on vacation. So like Adam came in that night and like flew to some like finance minister's conference and like threw together some crazy podcast about like what does this mean for the world and just started doing it all week. And because then everything went to hell that week. And
you were on vacation?
I was on vacation. Then I got back and he was like, oh man, I've been working like 24 hours a day. I'm so glad you're back. We got to do a big story. And so then we just like threw together this big story for This American Life, which was called Another Frightening Show About the Economy. And that was like a big hour. That's when we talked about the commercial paper market and credit default swaps. And we just did this like hour long explainer about like what the hell was going on. And then by January, I was like, okay, this is a story that's like, you know, the world might be ending, you know, like as we know it. You know, this is like a big, big deal. Like things have gone. So this is like a story that I want to stay on. So that's when I had sort of committed fully to Planet Money.
Was the idea just to apply that same style and approach to this kind of like world of financial trauma?
I feel like I learned a lot of like rules about like how do you tell a long, complicated story on the radio.
What are the rules?
This American Life. You have to pay really, really close attention to pacing. You have to go slow where you need to go slow. You want to have it be character driven. You want to be looking for emotional moments, moments of humor, moments that sort of like the listener can connect to. And you want to be telling it in a super straightforward narrative. Like, you know, first this happened and then this happened and then this happened. Like people are hardwired to listen to. Like I went out the door this morning and I was like walking to work and I saw my neighbor and then I looked up in the sky. And you know, I would never believe what I saw. And like people are going, well, what'd you see? You know, like it's like we're hardwired to want to know what we saw. And like that's sort of the trick. You just want to sort of like do that over and over again in the story. And as long as you're doing that, you can tell a story about anything.
I have more questions about audio engagement.
Yes.
And the future of audio engagement.
Mm-hmm.
We have not even mentioned this new thing that you're doing.
Right.
you went from Planet Money and you have now started your own thing. I assume that most people listening to this podcast have also listened to your podcast.
Right, although you can't assume.
I think it's a fair assumption.
Well, you know, like what I did on the last episode.
Oh, right, with the cereal thing.
Yeah. I had this like thing on the last episode of Startup, which is the podcast about the starting of my podcasting company. I was like, you know, just as an aside, I started talking about Serial, the super famous podcast, the fastest growing, most popular podcast in history, launched by my friends and colleagues at This American Life. I started talking about Serial on my podcast, Startup. And just as an aside, I was like, I'm sure everybody's heard of Serial, but I'll just do a perfunctory. Here's what it is. And by the way, if anybody hasn't heard of Serial, tweet at me. And like well over 100 people. Like it's like almost 200 tweets now that I've gotten where I was like, the first time I've heard of Serial, regular listener to Startup. I love This American Life. Never heard of Serial. Like you just don't know what people know. Like you, what I realized, and then I went and talked to like our audience, and it's just sort of like people come to you from all different angles and ways. It's really interesting.
Okay, fine.
Anyway, sorry.
No, that's fine. Maybe someone is listening who has not heard your podcast, which is called Startup and is about the starting of your podcast company,
right,
which is called Gimlet.
Yes.
Which is where we are right now.
Yes. Gimlet headquarters.
Gimlet headquarters. What do you think of Serial?
I saw you pause where you're like, I have all these interview questions that I want to ask him, but I also want to know what he thinks of Serial.
Yeah, I do. I mean, well, I actually don't even really... This is a little disingenuous because you and I have actually talked about Serial before.
Uh-huh.
I sort of know what you think of Serial. What I don't know is how you feel about having started a podcast company the same like season as Serial and it not being Serial.
I feel amazing about that. Like Serial has done so much work for us. Like Serial has basically validated everything that I said at every single investor meeting. Like that there's a much bigger audience for this stuff than we had previously imagined, that if you sort of like start, if you're untethered from the institutions that came before, you can find that audience, you can make programming that audience will be super excited about. So, and not to mention like, you know, millions of people listened to Serial and like that was the first podcast ever and they're like, oh, I like podcasts, what else is there? You know, and so like, you know, we're all benefiting from that, you know. Do I wish that we'd launched Serial? Of course. But like, you know, you know, don't want to get greedy. And I feel like I hope that we, you know, I hope that one day we will have a podcast that is as successful as Serial.
Do you think there's any chance we're in a podcast bubble?
If we're in a podcast bubble, then podcasts would have to be a fad that will go away. You know, in a
or
way.
Or just a bunch of people just listen to one, but they aren't going to listen to another one. Or a bunch of people were talking about one.
One and then didn't start listening
to
more.
Yeah, like maybe that was the peak.
Yeah. I mean, can you name another thing where that has happened?
Like where there was one big hit in a medium and then people
stopped caring about it. And then the medium disappeared?
Disappear isn't...
Right.
Isn't right. I mean more like, and I'm not, I don't actually believe this.
I
think podcasts are a pretty good bet, but I'm worried if I have read people saying that, mm-hmm. you know, they were kind of, it was kind of plodding along for a while.
Right.
And now it's like, it's having its moment and you're a pretty big part of its moment. I mean, obviously you believe that it can continue to grow. Otherwise you would not have started a company based on it continuing to grow. But I'm interested in whether you think there's a chance that maybe it won't. Maybe that last episode of Serial is going to be the most listened to podcast ever.
I don't know. I still feel pretty bullish. Like this is making me and part of what makes me feel like bullish is that this didn't come out of nowhere. This was entirely predictable. Like that there would be a breakout hit because like I'd seen it happening at Planet Money. Like Planet Money, the audience was growing, I don't know, 40% year over year. Every year that I was there, and then in the year after I was there, like it like more than double, it like doubled essentially. That could have been coincided with my leaving. I don't know, but like I like to think that it was just more like sort of like, you know, these secular forces that are sort of like the podcast app shows up on the iPhone for the first time. More people are listening in their cars. The habit becomes, you know, it's just easier now. People can do it now.
What about, it was like this week, I think CBS just said they're going to like start a podcast
network. Yeah, I heard that too.
Is that good for you? I mean, is all of this stuff good?
I think it's all good. I think that we're like at the point right now where like nobody's stealing market share from anybody at this point. Like I think we're at the very early days. To me, it feels like, you know, back when like there was like a couple movies and they were all up a train going around a bend. You know what I mean? Like it wasn't like we're still like pretty early. And like for in audio, it's like a lot of rediscovering because like there was this period where there was this golden age of audio in the 20s and 30s and then like it got destroyed by television. But I think that's where we're headed again. Like I think there's just like there's just all this capture time now where people want to be consuming media and you know, you're running an errand, you're working out, you're driving, you're mowing your lawn, you're driving your car, you can't read and you can't watch, but you can listen. It's pretty obvious that that pie is going to grow a lot.
How do you think this sort of heavily reported, heavily produced narrative journalism slice of the pie is going to do? Like, I got here, we talked for about 2 seconds, we sat down, we started talking. Our amazing editor, Jenna, is going to like make this sound great, or at least like as good as it could possibly sound. And she will spend a decent amount of time doing that. But it'll be up in 3 or 4 days, you know,
right.
It's pretty quick and dirty. It's going to get like done and turned around. Well, and the kind of stuff that you guys are doing is quite a bit more involved. Aaron and I were just on Reply All. This is like your first show, you know, and like that was a real process. We came back several times.
Yeah.
Alex reported the hell out of it. He was like, you know, it was a month probably putting that together.
Right. Not working full time.
Obviously.
Yes.
Yeah. I mean, like it was
it
just.
It took a month to do. Yeah, totally.
And I wonder whether. I don't know, like maybe like the corollary is like reality TV, like what we're doing is reality TV to like versus like scripted television or something. Like, does it hold appeal to do kind of two-way talkers?
I think podcasting has been, you know, made up primarily of that because that's been one of the few things that the business model can support because the audience has been pretty small. So I think if the audience grows and you get the same CPMs, the same ad rates on a bigger audience than you on a smaller audience, that gives you you can do more than you know, it becomes financially viable to do more. There seems to be a link between the size of audience that you can hope to attract and the level of production that goes into something. Like if you look at the very top of iTunes, most of the stuff that's up there is sort of like is the stuff that takes the month to produce rather than like
Of that is connected to This American Life though.
Right.
I mean, the other thing that's very helpful to have is to launch your show on This American Life.
Very helpful.
It's super
very
useful.
Helpful. I will not lie. That helps a lot.
So like there's a question I think about whether it's the value of like the reported heavily produced or whether it's also like the Ira Glass Mafia.
I think it's absolutely both. Like you need both. Lots of podcasts have aired on This American Life and they have different they get different the iTunes rankings differently afterwards. And I'm thinking about stuff that doesn't have anything to do with Ira either. Like Radiolab, yes, there was a story that was on This American Life from Radiolab, but I think that would be This American Life would never take credit for Radiolab's success. Freakonomics is another one where like I don't think they've ever been on This American Life. They had another base, they had the Freakonomics books, but like I know it's interesting. Like you look at these big brands like The New Yorker, you would think like here's this renaissance of sort of long form journalism on the air with This American Life and Radiolab and all this sort of stuff and Freakonomics and Planet Money and all these people who are doing it. Why isn't The New Yorker higher?
There's a distinction with The New Yorker, I think, which is that the goal of those podcasts, as far as I can tell, appears to be to get people to stop listening to the podcast and to read the magazine.
I don't want to trash talk The New Yorker.
No, that's not even necessarily, right. Like, I think that's, like, they're talking about stories that are in the magazine week. Like,
right.
That's not trash talk. That's right. Like, they're supporting material for like the mothership.
Yes.
And it seems to me like if they were New Yorker stories done as a podcast, they would probably have the same reach.
As what?
as The New Yorker, as you're doing, or whatever. If they were standalone artifacts.
You're saying what I'm saying. So the truth is, we don't know, right? Right now, like, what seems to get you to the top is sort of like Serial has shown, like, and Serial's numbers are like sort of like so amazingly insane.
Yeah.
They're like doubling everybody else.
Right.
You know?
Serial's like a hit basic cable TV show.
Yeah.
It's crazy.
Yeah. So I don't know. I mean, I feel like the most popular talk product ever, I think, is the Howard Stern show. And like, could we do a podcast version of Howard Stern? Like, that would be awesome. Like, I would love to do that. You know, I would love to find a talent as like red hot and compelling as Howard Stern and give them an hour show every day.
You don't have like a evangelical belief in the narrative stuff. That's just what you know how to do.
It's what I know how to do. And it seems easy. It seems like there's plenty of room to play there. And it seems like that's what I know how to do best. You know, that's what we're going to start with. But I don't think we have to stay there. Yeah.
I want to talk a little bit with what you actually did start with,
yeah,
which is your podcast about starting the company.
Yeah.
Man, there's so much good tape.
Yes, there is.
There's so much good tape. It's like it's like endless good tape. And one of the things I found myself wondering while I was listening to it, I mean, I am also like have a co-founder and am working on a business. So like there's a bunch of things that were just like really heartening to hear you go through. And there's a lot of it that felt like very brave. I was impressed that you were putting it out there, you know, except I kept finding myself thinking about like, does he know the ending?
Oh, yeah. No, I didn't know it at all.
You didn't know it at all. So,
Oh, no. Not at all.
Were you confident that it was going to work out? It seems like it was like generally a pretty happy ending.
Yes, it was a very happy ending. Yeah. Was I confident it was going to work out? I was, although I'm not exactly sure why. Like, I was.
A lot of the good tape is the moments where maybe you didn't think it was going to work out.
Oh, yeah. No, that's the best stuff. No, and that was like one of the things like that was like really, really weird about doing this project is that like as a producer, I knew that, you know, like I know the part where like Chris Sacca is like, you're doing this all wrong. Here, let me give my pitch back to you. Like I was like, holy shit, that's good tape.
Right. You're sitting there being like, this is terrible for my business, but it's
horrible.
Really good for the podcast.
Yeah, exactly. And then the part where like that guy, one of the investors, like we're at this meeting and like we do this big pitch and it's going really well. And then he's like, and then I say, are you in? And he's like, actually, and then they shoot us down on tape. And they say, like, no, at this point, no. And there's this kid who does the whole sort of like the math of it for us, like sort of like you don't have a business acquisition model and all this sort of stuff. I was like, that was great. That was the producer in me was like, that was a great moment. And then the person trying to start the business was like, God damn it. I thought they were in.
Yeah.
It was really frustrating. And so it was a really sort of a schizophrenic experience, like knowing that like on the producer side, like knowing that this was good. And then on the, you know, but like also just wanting it to be over and not wanting to feel that tension. Same thing with like when we made that, like the Twitter mistake, we did an episode about this mistake we made on one of our ads. And that was like genuinely gut-wrenchingly, like I was like, oh my God, this, I've destroyed our company. And like in retrospect, it's ridiculous. Like a tweet isn't going to destroy you. But like for that day, it was like our first sort of mini crisis. And for a day, I felt like this is horrible. Like I've set us back months and like we might not recover. And like, you know, we've blown all the goodwill and like people are going to turn against us now. It's just like a horrible feeling. And like.
And at the same time, you were recording everything.
We were recording it because I was like, this is going to be good. I wish the drama didn't have to be centered in my stomach, you know, but yeah.
But you put it there.
Yeah, no, I know.
Along those lines, there's this moment that came up in a recent one, which is kind of the tension between being like a business person and being an artist.
Mm-hmm.
There's a lot in the show that sort of gets resolved, and there's some things that are left unresolved, and that felt like one of the things that's sort of unresolved.
Yeah.
Which is that tension, right? It's like, this is bad for my business, but good for the show. If you had to fall on one side, like, would you rather have had a good show or have it go well for the business?
Well, it's complicated, right? Because the show right now is the business.
It's super good for the business.
Yeah. So the show is doing well and the show is funding the business right now. Like we've got way more listeners than we thought and like we're getting, you know, good revenues on our ads. And so like that's putting us ahead of where we thought we were going to be because of we weren't banking on startup, you know, bringing in this much money at this point. So at this point, like anything that's good for a startup, the podcast, I'm happy with because it's also good for the business. Where it's going to be hard, I think, for me, if we are to grow into like an actual large, you know, media company with like multiple properties and multiple shows and like we're, you know, bottom lines and a big staff and stuff, we're eventually going to have to start doing shows that like I personally don't like that much.
Because of like the law of averages, or because you just can't have your hand in everything?
Just because, well, no, just because, like, you know, eventually you're going to want to start, maybe there's a great business in like a needlepoint podcast or whatever. You know what I mean? Maybe it's like a really, maybe it's a slam dunk from a business perspective.
There's good tape in needlepoint?
Yeah, and well, no, but like maybe there's like a whole group of people who love needlepointing and they've been brought into the world. I don't know. You know what? I don't know. But I feel like, you know, just like there's a lot of stuff out there that I don't, that's really popular that I don't listen to very much. And like, I would be like, I don't know, it's not to my taste, but like it does well. There's like stuff at the top of the charts that like does very well that I listen to. There's a lot of stuff at the top of the charts that I actually do like, which is sort of really comforting. But like, are we going to get to a point where like we have to do a show that like I personally don't like that much, but like, you know, a shock jock or like some sort of morning zoo show, or you know what I mean? The first morning zoo show on the podcast world or whatever, you know what I mean? Like Mickey and the Mad Dog, you know, like coming to you live, you know, whatever.
Don't talk badly about Mike and the Mad Dog.
Oh yeah. Mike and the Mad Dog. No, I mean, I was not the
please
actual.
Please get back together, Mike and the Mad Dog.
Not the actual Mike and the Mad Dog. I was using that more generally, like the Mike and the Mad Dog.
If
phenomenon.
You can bring Mike and the Mad Dog back together, that'd be a boon.
So, Mike and the Mad Dog, if you're out there and you guys want to do a podcast.
They're definitely out there.
Yeah.
The moment you're not sure where you fall is when the business needs to do a show that you, the producer, thinks is kind of shitty.
Me, the for lack of a better word, for, to use the pretentious word, the artist, you know, the person who's like, my sole job used to be producing
right.
this stuff. And like, and in that sense, the only sort of compass was sort of like, do I like this? And if I like it, can I figure out ways that other people might like it as well, but it proceeded from me. It was like my taste, my aesthetic, my curiosity, whatever. And at a certain point, that can't guide things anymore. It has to be the aesthetic of groups of people, of different audiences out there. And if like there's an audience out there that really wants a podcast that we can deliver that I don't particularly like that much, we should deliver it. You know what I mean? Like that seems like it's a no-brainer from a business perspective.
Do you think that you will remain curious and engaged at that point? Like, will you want to keep doing it?
I don't know. At this point, it's a distant problem, and it's a very, very, it's very much a problem of sort of like, it's a hypothetical problem. Like, because right now, there isn't really a tension between, you know, growing this business and my art, to use the ridiculous, pretentious word that we've chosen.
Right now, you're like, your art is the business.
Yeah, exactly. And that's awesome. That my art is the business is amazing. And that's like awesome. But I feel like the way we're building the company right now, it won't continue to be that way. Like, you know, like it will guide, it, you know, my tastes will guide our choices for, you know, the next year or 2 years, something like that.
That's been part of the tension of listening to you on Startup that's been so compelling to me is it's about whether you can do something on the scale that you aspire to do it in and be sort of like true to yourself, or whether you have to on some level become a douchebag.
Exactly. And that gets back to the, you know, like I think the way this tension manifests itself for me is sort of like, how big do we want to get? Do we want to get big to the point where I'm like, I have to be thinking about this stuff? Or can we just sort of like, can we grow like a nice sized media company off of like 10 or 15 things that I personally like? And maybe we can. You know what I mean? Like that's the thing that's sort of crazy is sort of like it's entirely possible that we could.
Is that the best case scenario?
I mean, for some of our investors, it's maybe not the best case scenario. I think for most of our investors, it probably is, as long as we're like once you reach an audience of 500,000 or 1 million people, like if we can get to that level with a bunch of shows, then you can bring in like decent revenue. Like you can bring, you're like a, if you have 10 shows with 1 million listeners, you know, you're like, you know, tens of millions of dollars in revenue. And like you could be pretty big. We'd be 10x at that point if that
right.
was the case. Yeah.
Although it seems entirely unlikely to me that if you had 10 shows that were getting 1 million listeners, that you'd be like, all right, great. We did it.
I guess so, right?
Like if you'd done it, you'd be like, let's get that needlepoint show in here. Let's fucking do it again. Like
right.
that is the instinct, right? I mean, that ambition in some way is what led you to start this.
Yeah.
If you were just comfortable with what was aesthetically pleasing to you, then you would just be still at this
I
American
don't know.
Life.
I mean, but I have pretty mainstream tastes on the other hand. Like I do like, you know, I loved Seinfeld. You know, I like, you know, I watch football. You know what I mean? Like it's not like, you know, I mean, I think that could be also the key is that we are sort of like we've been thinking of ourselves as highbrow, but we're basically sort of just sort of like right in the middle, and like they're just purely people just don't know about it, and once they know about it, they like it. Like I have thought of public radio as this sort of like elite sort of thing, you know, like sort of like this like acquired taste that's only of a certain, you know, whatever. It's like super bougie and super sort of like rarefied, you know. But one of the weird things about startup is that like just a lot of people that are not public radio fans that are not like, you know, people that I would never necessarily have thought of as the audience are listening to it and loving it in a way that like makes me feel like I think public radio had this weird sense of itself where it was actually much more mainstream than it even thought of itself as. And it just didn't market itself that way. And so people didn't know about it or something.
How are you feeling about like the future of public radio? Are you bullish on that?
How am I feeling about the future of public radio? I'm bullish on parts of it. First of all, the change never happens fast. So like I think in 20 years, will there be drive time radio? 30 years? Probably not the way we think about it now, right? So like terrestrial radio carried by satellite, you know, delivered to radios and cars, like I don't think that's probably not going to be around in the too distant future. But like, you know, listenable stuff, you know, that people want to hear, I think that's definitely like I feel like I'm betting my whole, you know, the company on that. And so to the extent that public radio can deliver is one of the best delivery mechanisms for that stuff, I think the future is bright.
I think the reason I was asking so much about the tension between like the business and the art thing, I had this moment recently. I went and like spoke to a J school class, and I think that I was supposed to like create a presentation, but I didn't, and so I just walked in, and was kind of like, "Hey, do you guys have any questions?"
When did it dawn on you that you were supposed to have something prepared?
Like 1 second before I walked in the classroom, like. It had been like a vague invitation.
It's like a bad dream.
It was terrible. Anyway, so I was just like, I don't know, let's talk. Well, you can ask questions. And half the questions, I would say, from this class of student journalists were about starting a business. It seemed quite clear to me that their aspirations upon leaving journalism school were to figure out how to start something themselves.
Right.
Because maybe their jobs weren't there or whatever. And these questions started mounting. Like, at some point, I was just like, you know, there's like another school on this campus, very close to us. That's like a business school, where maybe you could learn. They would have better answers to these questions. You might be in the wrong school if you're really interested in the business of this stuff.
Right.
There's like a bunch of people over there who are really smart about business. Like these people can teach you how to write stories. And then it's a totally perfect moment where I like. I left, you know, it ended, and I was kind of just like, wow, that was weird. Why were we talking about business the whole time? And then the professor walked me out, and we, like, got in the elevator, and he was like, before you go, I really wanted to run my startup idea by you. And I was just kind of like, oh, God. But
we're definitely in a startup bubble.
Yeah. Well, but the question is, like, aside from why the market was right and, like, people are moving to digital audio and all that stuff, A, what made you want to make the leap where you were doing the business and where the business was on you and the business had the chance to be really successful or fail, which is a little bit different than public radio and nonprofits and stuff? And secondly, like, do you think you could have done it at any point before now? So I think there are a bunch of really young people, some of whom may be listening to the show right now, who are thinking about how, man, I cannot get in the door at any of these places. I need to just like try and start my own thing. Mm-hmm. I wonder whether you think you could have done this earlier.
A little bit. I mean, I feel like part of it is that like all these dynamics that are going on, you know what I mean? Like, so I don't think I could have done it much earlier. There wasn't like a robust ad market in podcasts, right? Like right now, a lot of our problems are solved for us. Like, you know, so like the problem of selling ads on your podcast, right? Like if I'd started this five years ago before the ad seller that we both use, Midroll, we would have had to come up with like a way of like selling our ads, and we would have had to like develop all those relationships ourselves, and we would have had to do all that stuff. And so I don't think the market was there. So like, I don't think there was that many listeners enough. So I don't think I could have done it. And then me personally, I certainly wasn't ready to. I think for me, that's the biggest thing is that like, I'm really like late to stuff. Like it took me forever to get into journalism. I'm old now, you know, I'm almost 50, you know, I've just been always this way. Like it just takes me a long time to like do anything. And it wasn't until I was like, you know, around this age that I was like, I think I could run something. I could manage some people and like try to take on the challenge, but I would not have been ready to do it before this. So to me, that was part of the, like, that's exciting. That's the exciting part, is sort of like running the company is exciting, you know, and like having employees and like having, you know, creating a hospitable environment where people are excited about doing stuff. And like, that's all exciting now. And I don't think it would have been before. It would have just been stressful and I wouldn't have been good at it.
How many more episodes of Startup are you going to do? Like, can you just keep documenting this forever?
No. And I feel like at a certain point, like, I mean, so there's a big sort of letdown. Like, I mean, that's part of the problem, is sort of like, it's way more exciting to watch a house burning down than a house being built, right? Like, and so like in the beginning, when there's like lots of like tension and lots of like, you know, like I'm falling flat and like there's like, am I going to do it? Am I not? There's like all this tension built into it. And now that tension is sort of resolved a little bit. So the goal is to sort of transition to documenting other companies. And that's going to happen in the next month or two. We have a couple more podcasts about our company going forward. And like last week, again, fortunately for the podcast, unfortunately for us, was like a really rough week, which we're going to be talking about on the podcast. So like there was like, you know, so there's more tension back in it. But I feel like at a certain point, it's just sort of like, okay, what are they going to say at the story meeting this week? You
right,
know what
right,
I mean?
Right.
Like, it's so sort of like,
those guys just went to work again.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Right. I feel like already we've had a couple episodes that I think are good, but.
Yeah. I mean, there's like a, there's a pretty significant difference between, will I be able to raise this money? My family's going into debt, and my wife, who is awesome, is like clearly very anxious.
Right.
And there's like $1.5 million in the bank.
Yeah.
That's like, it's hard to get back over that wall once you've jumped it, you know?
Right. Exactly. You know, there's like a couple things, like we've been like the tension this week has been sort of like, people are like burnt out. Like it's just been like this grind getting all the shows out. And that's like, that's a real issue. But I think, yeah, we're definitely ready to wind it down and start talking about other companies.
Well, I look forward to it.
Yeah.
Thank you for taking the time.
Thank you. It was really fun.
It looks like while the boss was in here recording this, everyone left.
Okay.
Thanks for listening to Longform. I'm Max Linsky. My co-hosts are Aaron Lammer and Evan Ratliff. Our editor, who did a particularly good job on that episode, is Jenna Weiss-Berman. Our intern this week, Rachel Mabe. Thanks so much to them. Thanks to our sponsors, Alarm Grid, Tiny Letter, and Lynda.com. And thanks very much to Alex Blumberg for taking the time and teaching me a little something about good tape. We'll see you next week.